Are you ready, Susan?
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. We're on the record. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. I had an occasion to go before the Senate Finance Committee this morning at 9 a.m., and Chairman Senator Stedman began by saying today is February 8th, 2010. And I appreciated the formality that that brought to the record. Therefore, here on the 8th of February, we are convened. In attendance are Representative Robert Lynn, Representative Maxwell Gruenberg, Representative Jay Rammers, Representative Nancy Dahlstrom, Representative Lindsey Holmes. We anticipate seeing Representative Carl Gatto, who is arriving on the 115 flight, and it's on the same flight, is that correct? And Representative Heron is on the same flight. I want to take just a brief at ease. So today, for once, the weather pattern that we're fighting is actually in Washington, D.C., and Andy Carpinetti, who hails from Juneau, is experiencing Juneau weather on the East Coast. And so we are graced to have Mr. Stabodny here. We do look forward to moving through House Bill 298. I would prefer to have Representative Gatto and Heron here for 298. So the first piece of legislation that we're going to take up is going to be HJR 8, and if we get through that and we're still not here, we may begin with the introduction of HB 316 and then wait for Representative Heron and Representative Gatto to arrive here, because the crime bill, I think, is comprehensive enough that it's important to me to have the full membership here. And Representative Gatto has an amendment on the table that he would prefer to speak to, and so in deference to our friend, I want to make sure that we finish that piece of freight when our two missing members have rejoined us. So with that, what we'd like to do is to take up HJR 8 by Representative Mike Kelly. I see our friend Derek Miller is here to speak to that. Derek, if you want to pop up here. If I recollect, we had set that bill aside over the weekend so that Representative Holmes could do some research on that piece of legislation. Representative Holmes, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And given that we were talking about a constitutional amendment, and I just wasn't quite clear on what exactly it was doing, I appreciate you holding it over for the weekend.
Absolutely.
The sponsor's office has been good at coming back to us and answering the questions, and so I'm more comfortable with my understanding of the bill at this point.
Okay. And Derek, you and I talked about this briefly in the hallway. If you could just give us a sense of where we are and the issue that was covered, make sure that we have it on the record so that it's satisfactory to Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Derek Miller, staff to Rep. Kelly. And the question that came up in the previous hearing, the concern that came up, was mostly regarding that five-year average in the calculation, calendar year versus fiscal year. And I believe we have hashed that out and addressed that with the representative's office, and Tam Cook has helped us out in fleshing out the answer to that question. So I believe if the committee's satisfied, I think that that's where we left it.
Okay. And Representative Holmes, you're good to go. It is a constitutional amendment, so we're sensitive to that. Any other members with questions? Representative Holmes or Representative Dahlstrom?
Would you like a motion?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Joint Resolution Number 8, 26-LS0388/A, with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Just for the record.
Always.
My vote will be a no rec, and I've limited my examination of this strictly to the legal issues, constitutional issues, as the chair instructed. And I just wanted to put that on the record. I'm expressing no opinion on anything else.
Duly noted. With that, are there any objections to the motion? Seeing none, HJR 8 passes from committee. And we're pleased to see it move to the Finance Committee, where it will enjoy appropriate scrutiny on its
fiscal.
So with that, we'll take the brief of these.
Mr. Chairman, my name's Rick Sabodny. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I want to start off by thanking the committee for hearing this this bill quickly. And I wanted, before I get into the sectional analysis, just make a couple of remarks. As you have all heard from the Attorney General, there are several bills this legislative session that deals with an initiative to end domestic violence and sexual assault within 10 years, or more realistically, to reduce our position from one of the worst in the nation to hopefully one of the best in the nation in dealing with this. This bill does three things that relates to sexual assault and domestic violence. It starts with creating a system for the retention of evidence in certain types of cases, basically in homicide cases and sexual assault cases. That retention of that evidence is for specific periods of time, both prior to somebody being charged with an offense. So the cold cases, that evidence should be retained for substantially longer than it is now. There is no standard now, and a police department can get rid of evidence basically in an unsolved case whenever they want. I guess just anecdotally, I'll tell you the worst case I ever dealt with is when the Juneau Police Department moved from downtown to their present location, and behind a filing cabinet, a file emerged about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and it was the death of a 7-year-old in this community in the 60s. And I took that and I believed that I could prosecute it, but there was no evidence left. They didn't keep the evidence. There are no standards now in this bill, but sets some standards for serious cases. So you can see that it has that effect. It also has the ability, the requirement of retaining that evidence also deals with post-conviction relief, which is the second part of this bill. Post-conviction relief is lawyers' terms for after somebody has been convicted of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt, of coming back to court after all the appeals are done and saying still that there are some reason why, after having all the safeguards of the criminal trial and the appellate process, that their conviction should be set aside. This is necessary because these changes are necessary in our post-conviction relief procedures because of the advent of DNA analysis that will assist the criminal justice system in making sure that the right person is convicted. So obviously, whether it shows after conviction that the right person was convicted or that the wrong person was convicted, we go out and look for the right person, that affects the sexual assault and domestic violence. Most DNA cases come from homicides and domestic violence cases. Thirdly, the bill creates a task force to deal with standards for evidence collection. We have not been the best that we could be in keeping police officers up to date on things like digital photography, digital recordings, DNA, and it would create a task force to set standards for both the state troopers, for all law enforcement in the state. This bill basically deals with DNA testing, and I'm sure you're all aware that the state of Alaska was involved in a case last summer before the U.S. Supreme Court that dealt with DNA testing. That case is a case of was state of Alaska versus Osborne before the Supreme Court. The media dealt with that case in a way that was, they typically do, in a way that was most sensational, and talked about how, you know, Alaska, that there were 46 states that had specific statutes that dealt with post-conviction DNA testing, and Alaska wasn't one of them. That's not quite accurate. Alaska was one of those states. It was accurate in that it didn't have a statute. Its decisions about post-conviction DNA testing were made in that particular case by two decisions by our Court of Appeals. It is generally the Department of Law's belief that it is better that laws are made by the legislature as opposed to the Court of Appeals, not because we think that either this body or the Court of Appeals is more intellectually capable of making good laws. It is rather that when the Court of Appeals does it, they do it in a case-by-case situation, so it's piecemeal. It may take decades to get the full area of the law developed, and when the legislature does it, it does it generally as a package dealing with all the public policy calls at one time. There were other things that Osborne case did. If the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision would have stood, their premise was that in every case, their decision could have been read that in every case, forever, DNA or evidence, all evidence, would have to be retained by law enforcement, which would frankly just cause law enforcement to come to a halt. Right now, Colonel Hoddy sitting back behind me has warehouses full of evidence, but they move it out. When the case is over and it's not likely that when it's not appealed, they get rid of it when they would have been under Osborne force under one reading of it to keep it forever. And finally, what the Osborne case did was the Ninth Circuit sought to federalize, to set federal law as the standards for how we deal with our cases after conviction, and the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was not going to federalize that type of law. It was better left to the states. So it's our opportunity now to come back before you and present it to the states, to this state. A lot of people have been interested in this subject. Representative Linda had a bill in at the end of last session to deal with DNA testing. Senator French has a bill that deals with the retention of evidence. There's been a lot of interest. There's been a lot of input in this bill by different parties. The Department of Law has been involved, but throughout we've been talking to law enforcement and to the Public Defender Agency, and everybody who's had an interest in this matter has hopefully had the opportunity to speak to it. So let me go through, if you will, Mr. Chairman, the sections of the bill.
Mr. Sabodney?
Yes, sir.
It's an excellent presentation so far. When are we going to get some real fiscal notes for this? There are four fiscal notes, and two of them are for zero, and two are for $4,000 each.
Mr. Chairman, I think you have real fiscal notes, and I know that may sound
unrealistic.
Unrealistic and maybe even self-serving on my part. But let's put it this way.
Yes.
We spent a lot of money.
A pause right there and just enjoy that.
Reflect general laughter around the table.
These cases are going on, the post-conviction relief cases now. We have, frankly, most states in enacting post-conviction relief statutes, and I'll get into how this follows most states in a moment, have restricted the area of post-conviction relief to, how to say this? Let me give you two examples, and I can't keep these in mind, which is California, which is the United States. But one of those jurisdictions only allow for post-conviction relief in DNA matters when the person's still incarcerated. And the other state limits it to when the person is out of jail, but during the period of time that they're on probation or parole. Kentucky limits it to, I believe, just death penalty cases. As I get into this bill, you'll see that it's limited to really to crimes against people. So with the decision that we have from the United States Supreme Court, we're wide open. If it's littering under the Osborne decision, somebody could ask for post-conviction relief, and we would be needing to litigate that. So in Alaska right now, it's wide open, and this bill will restrict the number of cases that ultimately that we can be getting now and could have been getting. I'm not saying that very well, but I think they're actually probably pretty realistic.
So. Just to back on the fiscal note thing for a second. So Section 16 talks about creating a task force to consider and recommend standards for preservation of evidence. And that task force is going to include the AG, the commissioner of a DPS, chief of police from a rural community, a chief of police from one of our urban communities, the state medical examiner, somebody from the crime lab, and the court system, and a victim's advocate. And you don't think when we assemble those seven or eight people that they're not going to generate a whopper of a fiscal note? They're going to say that everything that we're doing is already within the province of how we're presently handling and storing evidence?
I expect that and that's where the Department of Law's $4,000 were to deal with these people. I expect that they will establish criteria that police officers will follow throughout the state. There are, and I'll talk about this in a few minutes, there is an unfunded mandate in any evidence retention. That will exist for police departments. But when you establish standards, it's not going to cost a police department any more money to figure out how you save a digital recording and when you can get rid of it than kind of the piecemeal approach that we have now. So in that specific section, the gathering of the people, all those people are public servants. It's, you know, on the time that they're going to get paid now. They'll establish how police officers should do good evidence gathering, what the standards are for doing that. So whether they say it's better to save a shirt that has blood on it in a paper bag than a plastic bag where it can have the effect of disintegrating the evidentiary value of that shirt is not going to cost the amount of money I think you're envisioning.
So Mr. Spani, to whom does the unfunded mandate accrue to the local law enforcement? Who does the burden fall to then?
In Section 3, when we get to it, it falls to the police agencies, which means local police agencies and state police agencies. They do it now, but in that section, they'll be required to do it for lengths of time that are defined by the statute before they're able to destroy a piece of evidence. So they'll know now what that length, if this bill passes, what that length of time will be. And just another example, the Anchorage Police Department in one of our Cole cases saved a Jeep for 10 years and thought, well, now it's time to get rid of it. This bill would have saved them that storage cost of the Jeep, because what was important on it was some blood, and this will tell them how they can save that particular biological sample and get rid of the Jeep, or notify people through the court and get rid of the Jeep. So I can't tell you how much it will cost them or save them, and I think it'll cost them more than it'll save, but it will let them know what the rules of the game are.
Could Mr. Sabatini, could the Colonel come up here and talk to us about what this means from the law enforcement point of view while you're here, since we're just poking around this thing so we can...
I think that'd be a great idea.
Yes.
May I just ask this?
Representative Grunberg.
Before you go back,
Officer,
the safety of the audience, do you believe that the makeup of the committee on page 15, lines 16 to 24, is balanced?
Through the chair, balanced... Don't specifically know what you mean by that. I mean, if you need an even number, yes. If you mean an odd number and you want nine because there'll be a vote, you can split.
That's
no,
not
if you mean,
what I'm talking about.
Representative Grunberg.
If you mean...
Chair, that's not what I'm talking about.
I thought it probably was not, and that's why I'm getting ready to talk about. Is there a public defender, somebody from OPA, the private bar, on there? The answer is no. This is not something... when you are establishing, in my example, paper bags versus plastic bags, that you need that type of person, you need somebody from the defense bar or a group of people from the defense bar on this type of committee.
Do you, through the chair, if I may follow up?
Yes.
So you don't feel it's necessary to have anybody from the defense bar on that? That's the Department of Law's position?
I don't, through the chair, I don't think it's necessary now.
We'll come back to that.
Okay.
Just wanted to flag it.
Thank you.
Colonel? It's okay with you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just sit here because I assume that maybe
absolutely.
There will be questions.
Colonel, it's a privilege to have you before our committee. We thank you for your commitment and for your state service. And I know you were just in Fairbanks a few weeks ago with our young, our 20-year-old explosion guy in Fairbanks. And we appreciate you crisscrossing the state to keep all of us safe and to look out for public safety for all of us. Thank you. Are there any questions for Colonel Holloway? Representative Grunberg?
I don't know that we're at the point. We haven't even had the bill walk through. I just, since you were talking about Section 16, I just sort of left in with one question. I don't want my silence to be held as I don't have any questions at all.
Thank you. Colonel, how long are you here for?
I'm here till Wednesday.
Oh, you are, and you'll be with us Wednesday afternoon as well, is that right?
Unless it's at between 12 and 1.
1 to 3.
And okay. I'll be here.
Okay, 1 to 3. So we'd like to welcome Representative Herron, Representative Gatto. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
And gentlemen, we held House Bill 298 until you came in on the 115 flight. We're going to spend another 10 minutes or so on House I think we're at a place where we probably could stop. We will wait, Mr. Sabatini, if you want to stay up here to help us through HB 298. If you want to switch gears. Sergeant DeGraff, if you want to pop up here, we'd love to have you. We have closed public testimony on House Bill 298, but we have the sergeant here to assist with any questions. Mr. Sabatini is here. Sue Stancliffe is behind. We also have available from the public defenders Doug Moody, from public safety Kathy Manfreda, and Jeff Mittman from the ACLU is available for questions. When we had last met on this piece of legislation, we had two outstanding amendments, one offered by Representative Gatto, the other one was amendment number, that was number eight, I thought. There was amendment number eight was before us, and an amendment number 14, and then we have several other amendments that are to be offered, that are be offered today. And so, Representative Gatto, if you're ready to go, I think we'll take up amendment number 14 first, and then we'll take up the new amendments, and then we will close by taking up amendment number 8, which still remains kind of a sticky wicket for us. So with that, welcome back to Juneau. Representative Gatto, the floor is yours.
Chair, I'm going to withdraw amendment 14.
Amendment is withdrawn. Do you care to speak to it at all, or do you just want to withdraw it?
Withdrawn.
Okay. Thank you. So amendment number 14 is withdrawn. We then have amendment. A.24. And Representative Dalston, do you want to move amendment? This would be amendment number 15.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I wish to move amendment number 15, 26-GH2859-A.24.
So we have A.24 before us. Representative Holmes objects for discussion. And Sue, can you take us through A.24, please?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sue Stancliffe, Special Assistant and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for the opportunity to present this amendment. This amendment would amend statute in adding a new section in Title 44, authorizing the Department of Public Safety to use a administrative subpoena in collecting information, gathering information, very certain records involving exploitation of a child. There are the first section of the amendment relates to the authority, what we can go after, what we're looking for specifically, the name of the IP address holder, information related to the owner of that IP address. There are sections on page 2 of the amendment, C through, starting on subsection C, line 5, down through line 22, that are the stipulations, and the remaining lines are renumbering it accordingly. With me, I have Derek DeGraff, Sergeant DeGraff from the Cyber Crimes Unit, who can explain the process that we go through when investigating these cyber crimes, and that under no circumstances are we circumventing the subpoena process. This is just the initial phase of information gathering for an IP address associated with child exploitation.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Sergeant Brad.
Thank you for this opportunity to talk about this amendment and this bill. This is very exciting for law enforcement. This subpoena, admin subpoena authority, would be a tremendous asset to those investigators or detectives throughout the state of Alaska who investigate child exploitation cases. As technology has changed over the past 10, 15 years, many of these crimes that are initiated or started against children happen online. Current law dictates that if we are presented with a lead for a case and we have an IP address of a person behind a keyboard sending an email, sending a child pornography image or movie to somebody, posting things on the internet having to deal with child exploitation, chatting with an underage child online, we have to currently apply for a search warrant just to find out the account information that's related to that IP address. This takes a tremendous amount of time. It takes, on the average, 3 to 4 hours to be able to identify an IP address, write a search warrant, put something together, go to the court, obtain signature from the judge, get numbers, and then serve the search warrant. The subpoena would reduce that time by a significant factor for us. Having worked with our federal partners, this process takes 5 to 10 minutes to be able to get those same records. The records that we're asking for are very narrow in scope. They're simply asking for the name of the person holding the account behind the IP address, the address associated with the account, so we can actually determine where this residence or business or person may be. Local long-distance telephone connection records, these are not phone call records, but just the records indicating session times or durations for that account associated with that provider. The length of service that the person may have with that internet service provider and other types of service they may use through the same account. The telephone instrument number, other subscriber information that could be temporarily assigned through a network address for that account. The means and the source of payment for the service. That does not mean we get their bank records. That still requires a search warrant, but it would identify an account that we could actually target with a search warrant. Those are the key things that the subpoena will give us relating to these few offenses under Alaska statute dealing with child pornography. Throughout my travel and training in this arena over the last few years, I've been fortunate to go to several states and get training. Many states have adopted very similar law. This is modeled after many of those states to give law enforcement the tool and the tool belt to better help them combat child exploitation. So we're in a sense following what other states are doing, just kind of like we are with these other laws that we've been discussing, giving it more teeth, giving us those new tools as they become available as technology changes. And I'm here to answer any questions that the committee may have today.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand this correctly, you're not taking away we're not circumventing anything that's already in existence. We're just allowing that for this type of crime that you can get the information much quicker so you can react quicker.
That is correct, through the chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do apologize. I just was looking at this particular amendment in some detail over the lunch hour. It's a very comprehensive amendment, and I do apologize. I'm sure it was given out to me some point before my lunch hour, but that's when I started on it. I have several questions. First, page 2, line 6. Why is jurisdiction exclusively in the district court? Should it not be in any competent court? Because it may be that you'd have more access to a superior court. And unless there's a good reason to limit it to the district court, I think it should be either the district court or the superior court, and would propose we consider such an amendment.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Representative Grunberg, I think the word district court there is because this was basically the drafter of this amendment copied the federal law, and so I think he just picked up the federal district court and dropped off federal. Actually, that was one of my concerns, that it should be any court of competent jurisdiction in the state.
Mr. Chair, okay, if you guys want to take a cut at some proposed language and could give it to me, I will offer it at the appropriate time, and if that's what you want to say, through the chair. We could do it if you would, just in the next few minutes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. Or if I'd be pleased as the sponsor of this amendment to take any changes that you wish to add to this to make it have more teeth and do what you need to do, and we can offer it as all one amendment at the same time.
May I continue?
Representative Grunberg.
There is a statute currently on the books that I'm distributing now. It's AS 12.37.200. AS 12.37.300. And I'd also say 0.200. Two statutes very similar. 0.200 deals with pen registers and trap devices. And those are, as I understand from our legal counsel, pen register is an old type of, or at least a well-established type of a mechanism, so you can tell whom is called when you are trying to get a list of people, like people I'm calling or you're calling or something. And a trap device, I am told, is somewhat similar. And Section 300 deals with court orders authorizing or concerning access to or disclosure of communications in electronic storage. And both of these relate to as permitted under federal law. So I gather it is your intent to keep these two laws on the books and make a narrow exception in simply in cases involving exploitation or attempted exploitation of children. That would be a narrow exception to these rules where you don't have to get a court order, but you can get an administrative subpoena instead through the chair. Am I right?
Would you like to answer that?
Through the chair, the answer is yes. That these would still remain on the books. It would be a different process than this. The statutes you gave require that a police officer go to a court and establish, using the same standard that's in the amendment, that is a reasonable suspicion type standard, but they're still going to the court as opposed to an administrative process.
Through the chair, if I may continue, please.
Yes, Representative Gruber.
Thank you. This was basically based upon 18 U.S.C. Section 2703, required disclosure of customer communications or records, and the six items listed at the bottom of page 1 to the top of page 2 of the amendment, line 17, page 1 through line 4, page 2, are copied from the U.S. Code. And it looks like it's pretty well verbatim. That's what, at least what Mr. Lockoff says to me. My question relates to the final subsection 6. The means and source of payment for the service, including credit card or bank account number associated with the account. Are you familiar, Mr. Svobodny, with the case of State versus Christ, CHRYST, 793 P. 2nd, 538, Alaska App, 1990? Through the chair.
Through the chair. Not off the top of my head, if you want to give me the facts.
Okay. As I understand it, the facts are that a warrantless order to obtain certain electric records containing the customer's name and address, this related apparently to an agricultural operation in the Mat-Su borough. We need not go further with that for those of us who are familiar with that. But they wanted the name and address. And the basis for the holding was that there was no expectation of privacy in the name or address. However, that did not include things like your bank account number or credit card number, in which I think there is a different type of protection and a different type of privacy, not under the federal constitution necessarily, but the Christ case was a case involving the state right of privacy, Article 1, Section 22. And my question is, would there be, do you have any authority to show me that there is not an expectation of privacy in your credit card number or bank card number sufficient to strike that subsection 6 on a constitutional basis? I'm quite concerned about that, and that's just, I'm sorry, I have not really had a chance to study this, Nancy, and that's just, and this is my third question. I don't have any more at this point, but this concerns me.
Would you direct me to where you are in the amendment, please?
Yeah. I'm on page 2, lines 3 and 4.
Oh, subsection number 6.
Yes, sir. And I've been, Mr. Lockhart has given me three cases. I just glanced at one of these, but I think that we need to look at all of these under the right of privacy, Article 1, Section 22, which is a stronger and more specific right of privacy than there is in federal law.
Now, Mr. Svobodny.
Yes, sir.
Representative Gruenberg brings up a fine issue. However, The case that you're referring to, you cited State versus Crist, was 1990. Is that accurate?
That is.
This is the year 2010. This is 20 years later. Much has changed. And I think it's quite appropriate that we should put before the court a potential challenge to the precedent that they set in the 1990 case, because so much has evolved in the electronic world, and you, my friend, are living in the agrarian age, perhaps.
They were agricultural, not I.
Yes. You referenced something that took place in the agrarian age in Alaska, and we're now, I think, as the sergeant will tell us, living in the electronic age. So I find subsection 6 related to the electronic challenges that are put before us now. So I look forward to your answer, Mr. Sabodny, but I'd like for you to frame your answer between the two data points that are offered by my agrarian friend. And me, the the iPod guy.
Mr. Chair, just as if you're calling me an agrarian, that reminds me when they put Shirley Chisholm on the Agriculture Committee, and she said they must have read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
So, Mr. Spodney,
if I can remember the question. Through the chair, actually, as you gave me the facts, I recall the agricultural case from the Matanuska Valley. The holding in that case was that you could obtain the records of the Matanuska Electrical Authority, I believe, even though there was a provision that said that they would be held confidential. I may have that wrong. There was a debate in that case about whether that particular types of the record, certain things in the record could, in the records that the electrical company held. But the subscriber information, the location information was not held to be, our constitutional right of privacy was not implicated in those. That generally is referred to as subscriber information. I think to get more towards your question, we have a specific constitutional amendment that deals with the right of privacy. The federal government does not. The federal government recognizes the right of privacy, but I think with less rigor than the Alaska Supreme Court. I am unaware, as I sit here, of an Alaska Supreme Court decision that deals with bank information. I am aware of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that says that that bank information is not subject to an expectation of privacy, because when you give the check to the teller, you aren't keeping it secret anymore, and you expect that it goes through the process and it goes through to another bank, and they have held that is not confidential. That decision has been criticized by a lot of scholars over the years, and I think I don't know how the Alaska Supreme Court will come out, but I can tell you in the last 2 months, they've said that the citizens of the state have an expectation of privacy in their garbage, but it doesn't extend past the curb and into the dumping yard. So, I think it's going to be a close. It would be a close question.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg,
there was an early case, maybe the very first case, construing Article 1, Section 22. That said there was no right of privacy in your garbage. I think that may be the very first case in the annotation. Through the chair, did they, in effect, overrule that case? It sounds like they cut it back, and they said there's a more of a right of privacy today.
Through the chair, I think they are saying there's more right of a privacy. The distinction here was, and actually, they said there was a right of privacy, but as long as the police were picking it up on your curb, right, and not doing other things to get it. So that basically, it was a very strange decision, because they said you had an expectation of privacy, but it was okay for the police to go get it.
Yes,
let me just the quick distinction. Please. The case you're referring to was a a multi-person dwelling. So when it went into a hopper, it was different than putting it out on the street.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
The Crist case was cited to be by Mr. Lockhart. I don't know that he had shepherdized it, but I am somewhat concerned, and maybe this isn't as much as a question as a response to the chair's comment. I think we need to be very careful and look at the Crist case and these other cases. There are three cases to be sure that we are not going and passing something out that might well be contrary to given law in this state. And in most criminal cases, the Court of Appeals, if there's no petition for hearing has ever been filed, would be considered the definitive answer. And not just saying, well, I'm going to pass it out because the law may have changed in 20 years without any evidence that that's the case. That basically lets us write our own views of the Constitution, and I hope we're not going to do that.
With all due respect, Representative Grunberg, some of us at this table would tell you that that's what we think the courts are doing.
That doesn't mean we should do it. But I could cite a case from a couple of weeks ago, but I won't.
So just before we move on to Representative Holmes and your concern, I just want to make sure I've captured the three areas that you've identified.
So far.
So far. And so I have the district court reference, which is also on page 2 of that amendment. And does that show up anywhere else?
Gee, that's where I caught it.
Okay.
Page 2, line 6.
All right. So at the appropriate time, I'll ask the maker of the amendment to accept a conceptual amendment to the amendment that addresses conforming changes in language that was recommended to us by Mr. Sabodny. And what was that language, Mr. Sabodny? You said a competent court of jurisdiction?
Court of competent jurisdiction.
Court of competent jurisdiction.
May I just inquire for a second?
Representative
is that, would you, that, is that the language you'd prefer?
To the chair, I'd feel comfortable with that, actually. I drafted an amendment myself, and I can't remember what I think I put superior district court. Mm.
Okay. To the chair, which would you prefer?
Competent jurisdiction.
Okay.
And then, Representative Grunberg, we may have a disagreement on subsection 6 on lines 3 and 4, and then there was a third item that you had picked out in this amendment. Is that right?
It dealt with the use of these other two statutes that I passed out, and they've answered my question.
So you're satisfied.
On the record, let me just ask,
Representative Grunberg,
if I may. I don't quite see anything. Now, I don't want to say too much here.
Okay.
Subsection 6 was the only thing that leapt out at me as possibly violating Article 1, Section 22. That's not to say there may not be anything else. And with that, Mr. Svobodny, is there anything else that you see that we ought to take a look at besides subsection 6 in that list of 6 factors? If I may, through the chair, to Mr. Svobodny.
Through the chair, I had taken a different approach and a more conservative approach about what was obtainable mm-hmm. through the subpoena process. I don't know about 5 either. I'm not aware of a federal I'm not aware of a state case that deals with that.
Okay. Thank you. I would just, in an excess of caution, ask us to look at both of those. And I don't feel necessarily, it didn't leap out at me, but I want to be darn sure we're not doing something that's going to strike the statute down. That's my concern.
And we just want to refocus members that we're trying to be darn sure to give Sergeant DeGraff the right tools that he needs in an expedient fashion, because people that are using the internet for these kind of means, they're fast in and out, and we need to give law enforcement satisfactory tools to mirror their speed. Sergeant DeGraff, and then we're going to go to Representative Holmes, if you don't mind. We'll just go that direction.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, to Through the chair, I'd like to maybe follow up with a statement to Representative Gruenberg's question. Not the legal aspect, but the reason we want that specific record, referring to item number six. Part of our job is to gather the facts in any investigation. This tool gives law enforcement a much better idea, specifically item number six, prior to obtaining a search warrant for a residence that we were able to identify. If we're able to get a credit card number and a name associated with that, that is powerful information for us to help us early on in an investigation to help us ask the right questions. Working with our federal partners who are able to get very similar records through their subpoena process, when we are able to get these records or through state search warrant, and we are able to get the credit card name or number, many times you might think on one hand, well, it's going to help better identify suspects, but we've actually found in many cases it's actually helped exonerate people as well, because it's more accurate information going into an unknown residence where we may know that John Smith lives there, but we may not know that his cousin Fred is paying the internet bill, which could be some really key information from the get-go. So that's one of the reasons that is important to us to have in there, because it readily identifies, it clarifies the situation prior to obtaining a search warrant to move further into an investigation.
Thank you, Sergeant. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, this is probably going to be more to Mr. Sabodny. These types of subpoenas issued by the Attorney General, what other types of situations does the Attorney General have this type of subpoena power without the court?
Through the chair, OSHA, to go into a somebody's private property, pollution type of offenses, regulatory matters with the oil companies. Those are the three that come. Also in the area of consumer protection. So those are the four things that come to my mind off the top of my head.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up, are they written in obviously not the exact same information because you're looking for different things, but are they otherwise similarly written to this?
Through the chair, that's difficult. No, I think the answer is no. They're broader, but they're directed towards industry, as opposed, not to say that there's not somebody that would be a person in industry, I think they're generally broader than the draft that the amendment you have in front of you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may ask maybe a more specific question on that. For instance, here the burden seems to be there has to be reasonable cause to believe that certain behavior is taking place. Is that similar to the standards for others?
Through the chair, I don't have those statutes in front of me. I believe it is. I think it may be. There may not be any standard for consumer protection. I know that by case law there is for OSHA going, but again, you're going into somebody's property or onto somebody's property.
Okay. Thank you. I was just trying to, Mr. Chairman, get a feel for what we were comparable.
Representative Gruenberg, briefly.
Through the chair, Mr. Svobodny or anybody on the panel there, are you aware of any case that allows a warrantless search for a bank account or credit card number? Any state, any statute in Alaska?
Through the chair, I'm not.
I'm not going to offer an amendment on that. I don't think I'm flagging that. And as this makes its way through, I'll be probably doing some research, because I don't want to take it out unless I know there's a problem. But my gut feeling is we should do some research on that.
Thank you. We'll look forward to that report. So at this time, we have amendment number 15 before us. Representative Gruenberg, do you wish to offer an amendment to the amendment?
Yes, it'll be a conceptual amendment. Thank you, with the permission of the chair and the vice chair, the maker of the amendment. I'd like to strike the word district on line 6, page 2, and insert afterward the word court, the phrase of competent jurisdiction.
Thank you. And seeing no objection, with the amendment to the amendment passes. We now have Representative Gatto.
He said strike the word district, which makes the language awkward. You need to strike district court.
No. It's the court of competent jurisdiction.
Mr. Chairman, I'll object.
So we have an objection to the amendment to the amendment. Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's fine, but I'm wondering whether we need to say a court of competent jurisdiction.
I'll accept that as
a court of competent jurisdiction.
A friendly amendment to the amendment, if I could.
Excuse me. I was under the impression that this was a conceptual amendment. Susan, is that, are you and I on the same page?
I have a language down, and Jane would have a better idea.
So my Representative Grunberg.
May I change my amendment, please?
Do you want to just withdraw the amendment?
No. Okay. No, I just want to change that we'll also strike the word the, so it'll read a court of competent jurisdiction.
Is there any discussion over the new amendment to the amendment? Seeing no objection, the amendment to the amendment passes. We now have amendment number 15 before us. Representative Holmes, you objected for the purposes of discussion. Do you withdraw your amendment, your objection?
I'll withdraw my objection.
Seeing no other objections, amendment number 15 passes from the committee. We now have, yes, ma'am. Well, so we now have before us amendment number 16. Representative Holmes, you want to introduce a 26, is that right?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As soon as I have it in front of me.
Amendment 20.
Chairman, I move amendment number 16,
which
is amendment A.26.
Could we just have a minute?
Oh, here it is.
What number is this?
26.
Amendment A.26.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in here. Yeah, I'm going to have it here somewhere, I'm sure.
It should be on your table.
There it is. Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This deals with page 5 of the bill. I'll get back to it in a second here. It deals with section 5 on distribution of indecent materials to minors. It's come to our attention, Mr. Chairman, that there's no standard for what contained in this section for what indecent material to minors is, and therefore it's subject to a constitutional challenge. What this does, Mr. Chairman, is it actually defines what indecent material to minors means by giving a similar definition to what we found that we have in other parts of the bill for indecent material, except it makes a slightly tougher standard by saying it has to be indecent to somebody or inappropriate in various ways for somebody under the age of 16, which is a tougher standard, Mr. Chairman, than it would be for indecent material distributed to an adult.
So we have, I'm sorry, I don't know that anybody objected to this amendment. Did anybody object? Is there an objection to amendment number 16?
I'll object for discussion.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for purposes of discussion. Thank you, sorry. Is there any discussion on adding a definition as to what is an obscenity standard for minors? Seeing no discussion, Representative Dahlstrom, do you maintain your objection?
No, thank
God. The objection is withdrawn. Amendment number 16 passes without objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Holmes. We now go to A.25. Should be next in your packet. It's not. It's not numbered. It's by Representative Grunberg. It references page 6, line 29. Representative Grunberg, would you like to introduce amendment number 17?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The, it was dealing with amendment number 12.
Representative Grunberg, you want to move amendment number 17?
I move amendment number 17.
I'll object for discussion.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. Are we all on the same page?
And amendment number 12, which we adopted, changed the provision concerning the court rule change. And this would allow the court the jurisdiction to adopt any, issue any other courts that it considers appropriate in the interest of justice. And that would make it very clear that if the prosecution had something else, no, had any other amendment, had any other orders they wished, either for the prosecution or the defense, that they could do so.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the wrong amendment. Mr. Chairman, I think he was describing a different amendment than the one that we moved.
Wait a second. I thought it was A.25 he was talking about.
No.
Oh.
We're out of order.
Oh, all right. Okay. I've got it the wrong thing. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. James, I apologize to you. I thought he said it. Okay. So this is, okay, this is ongoing. Okay.
Are we all on the same?
I have to find, thank you.
Where are we?
Well, can you just stand at ease for a second? I don't want to take James's.
Okay. Just take a breath at ease. Representative Grunberg, we have before us your amendment number 17, which begins on page 6, line 29. Is that accurate?
Yes, sir.
All right. Would you like to take us through that amendment, please?
Yes, sir. Okay. This amends page 6, line 29, to specify that the aggravator must require that the defendant has engaged in an ongoing sexual relationship for the aggravator to apply, because somebody could have had a sexual relationship once with somebody else a number of years ago, and I don't think that was the intent here. And that's just to clarify, that's what we're talking about.
Thank you. And the objection was made by Representative Dahlstrom. Representative Dahlstrom, do you maintain the objection?
Yes, I'd like to hear from Sergeant DeGraff on that.
Okay. Sergeant DeGraff, come on up here, please.
Thank you, James.
Sergeant DeGraff, let me try and provide you some context along with Mr. Sabodny. On the bottom of page 6, section D, Representative Grunberg is advocating, and I don't know that I disagree with him, but this is a matter of the use of language,
right.
and that's the concern that Representative Dahlstrom has. Is were you? Are you now, or did you ever date that person? Are you violating somebody's rights if you used to have a relationship with them and now you violate, you know, the magic word of no? Is that different than if it's an ongoing relationship? So you dated him 3 years ago, is it the same thing as if you're presently dating them?
No, it only goes to the sexual relationship. It does not modify dating relationship, because a dating relationship, in my mind, implies an ongoing relationship. But a sexual relationship could be sex once or whatever.
You would take out the word asexual relationship and you would insert engaged in an ongoing sexual relationship.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we would like to get your point of view on that, Sergeant DeGraff.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
That would qualify.
I was not involved with the crafting this or the intent of the law, so I'd definitely like to pass this off to Mr. Sabatini.
Well said. Mr. Sabatini.
Mr. Chairman, this came to us through our the prosecutors in the Palmer office. They talked about both a dating relationship and sexual relationships as distinct things. The people are engaged in dating relationships where there's a trust relationship created, and they may not be having sex with anybody, and that they thought that ought to be an aggravating factor. An easy example of that is the young girl who was stabbed at the high school in Anchorage. She had a dating relationship. Because of that, the boy told her to close her eyes, and then she did it, and that's when she got stabbed. So it was intended to be two different things.
So the Department of Law is supportive of this amendment?
Is not supportive.
Not supportive.
Does not support.
Representative Herring.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm not convinced either. Is that Representative Gruenberg used a term of several years ago, which is fine, but what about a sexual relationship that was a week old? There was a separation of only a week. So I'm not convinced yet, and I like the way it's currently written.
Okay, the objection is maintained.
I'll withdraw the amendment.
The amendment has been, amendment number 17 has been withdrawn. All right, so do we have an ADOT 25 in our packets? I don't, I've been searching.
Yes, we do.
Dane, I don't have an ADOT 25. All right, so we have before us an amendment. I'm going to move amendment number 18. Or I'm sorry, Max, Representative Gruenberg. Do you want to move amendment number 18 for us, please, A.25?
I move amendment 18.
I'll object.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for purposes of discussion.
Mr. Chair, this technically amends amendment number 12, which we adopted last time, which was the court rule amendment. And the purpose of this is to allow the court to issue any other orders that it considers appropriate in the interests of justice. I think this may be implied, but I want to make it certain, because it may be for some reason that the prosecution would like to limit the things it must do under this proposed court rule amendment, and the defense may have some things it wishes to bring to the court's attention also. And we can't know at this point what those might be. The defense might like, for example, to limit some of the the prosecution might like to limit some of the opportunity of the defense for inspection of some of this stuff or whatever, and the defense might have some matters as well. And I just want to make it certain that this is in there so that the court knows it has jurisdiction to do it. And that's all.
Thank you. Mr. Sabatini, I'm since we don't have a CS before us, I'm looking at amendment number 12 at line 14 on page 1 of amendment number 12. Mm-hmm. And does the Department of Law have an opinion about this, Mr. Sabatini?
Mr. Chairman, I think the court has the ability to order certain things in discovery that are within the jurisdiction of the court. That's not a very good answer to you. you know, I guess I'm still kind of hung up on us. I mean, the whole idea of this provision was that the defense gets discovery, and I guess the concern is that we aren't going to give the defense discovery. The idea is that they just can't take it away. And if the court wants to enter an order that meets the parameters of the amendment, I don't have a problem with that, but I don't think this really says that. And it seems to me that the concern is something that we really haven't addressed. I mean, it sounds like it's misconduct on the part of the state that Representative Groomberg wants to address.
Thank you. So the objection is maintained.
Yes.
Susan, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Representative Herron?
No.
Representative Gatto?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Groomberg?
Yes.
Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Rammers?
No.
2 yes, 5 no.
All right, so amendment number 18 fails. Okay, brief at ease. So, Jane, I showed back on the record, it's 2:30. We are now to what I believe is the final amendment to House Bill 298. We are on amendment number 8, which was set aside. We'll bring amendment number 8 back before us. Can I have Amendment 8 is before us. Would somebody object for the purposes of discussion?
I'll object for discussion.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. Now we're going to take up an amendment to Amendment Number 8 to be offered by Representative Groenberg. I think members have before them the amendment to the amendment, which begins on page 2, line 17. It says, offered in the House Amendment 8 to HB 298. Are all the members on the same page?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Representative Groenberg, would you like to move the amendment to the amendment?
I'll move the amendment to the amendment.
I'll object for discussion.
Okay. Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. Mr. Groenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This cures a constitutional problem in the applicability provision. And the language currently says that the new provision will apply regardless of whether the conviction for the crime in the other state occurred before, on, or after the effective date of the act. Unfortunately, that runs afoul of a case from the Alaska Supreme Court entitled Doe v. State, 189 P. 3rd 999. In that state, the Alaska Supreme Court held that such a provision was prohibited as an ex post facto provision under Article 1, Section 15 of the Alaska Constitution, which prevented the state from requiring registration of those people who were convicted of crimes that were committed prior to the effective date of that act. And the court held that requiring them to register constituted punishment beyond what was permissible under the ex post facto clause. So what we're saying here is that they must register if their duty to register in the other state had not expired on the effective date of the act, if and only if the conviction for the crime in the other state occurred after the effective date of the act. In other words, if the crime in the other state occurred prior to the effective date of this act, they could not be required to register because that would violate the ex post facto clause of the Alaska Constitution, and this just cures that constitutional defect. I feel strongly that this would be a real problem if we don't adopt this amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Grunberg, though I understand completely your argument, but we're not requiring them because of, we're not requiring them to register because of their crime. We're requiring them to register because they're registered elsewhere. It's two different things.
I think that the court would say the same principle, though, applies. It doesn't make any difference whether they're convicted in the state of Alaska or the state of Tennessee. The fact is they were convicted of a crime that occurred before the effective date of this provision here.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Representative Grubert, I fully understand that. But we're not requiring them, we're requiring them to register because they're registered elsewhere. Period.
I understand what you're saying, and it strikes, if the logic of that would seem to be that if they've been required to register elsewhere, then that would not be prohibited by the ex post facto clause. And the Doe case admittedly doesn't deal with something that's the law of another state. The question would be whether that would operate to bar this state from requiring a registration. I think it would, and that's why I've offered the amendment that that just because you have to do it in another state does not absolve you of the ex post facto requirement here. I don't know the answer to that, but I think that what we're doing is asking for a constitutional challenge.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
One final comment. I guess given taking it in the whole, I guess it's, at least in my opinion, is I guess that taking that chance is worth it, because again, we're not putting them on the list because of the crime. We're putting them on the list because they're on someone else's list. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'd like to hear from Kathy Monfreda, please. Kathy, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Kathy, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, please. We're happy to have you before us.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kathy Monfreda. I'm the Chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau for the Alaska Department of Public Safety, and my duties include management of the Sex Offender Registry.
Kathy, do you have any thoughts on the amendment to the amendment, or would you rather speak to the amendment number 8 itself?
I think that Representative Grunberg may be correct. I think that it may have to do with, and perhaps Mr. Slobotny would be better placed to answer that question, but it's because of you're placing it as a definition, as a sex offense. You're defining the crime in another state as a sex offense in Alaska, that might apply to that Alaska Supreme Court decision. And we wouldn't be allowed to register them unless the crime occurred after the effective date of this act.
Thank you, Mr. Slobotny. If you'll just stand by for us, Kathy. Mr. Slobotny?
Mr. Chairman, I see it a little bit differently. The issue in Doe, whether it's retroactive, whether it can have a retroactive effect or not, is whether it's a punishment or whether it's regulation. And as Representative Herron said, we're simply regulating the people who come here as sex offenders. They've already been convicted in another state. In Doe, the issue was the people who hadn't been convicted before the effective date of the Alaska law, whether or not they were required to register. The U.S. Supreme Court said no. Our Supreme Court said yes in the very same case, just on how they weighed the different factors as to whether it was a punishment or whether it was regulatory. To me, The better analogy is like a DUI. Can you pass a law that says people who have been convicted twice before, if they do it a third time in this state, are going to be convicted of a felony? That's regulatory. So the line is, I think is close, and it's just how you weigh whether it's more regulatory or more punitive. If I could, it's a fight we're willing to take on.
Meaning that the Department of Law would prefer to oppose the amendment?
No, nope. Or to oppose, yes, the amendment. What I meant is we'll litigate this.
I'm happy that the Department of Law is taking a more aggressive posture to protecting those who have been overwhelmed by technology. So with that, Representative Dahlstrom, are you going to maintain your objection?
Yes, sir, I am.
Thank you. Susan, will you take a vote, please? Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair, the ACLU did a memorandum, part of a memorandum on this, and I'm wondering if Mr. Mittman's on the line and would like to testify on that limited issue.
Mr. Mittman, are you with us?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
We're really prepared to try and move on, but I'd like to hear from you. Can you try and keep your remarks as brief as possible, please?
Certainly, appreciate it. As Representative Grunberg stated, and as Mr. Shabatny stated, the Supreme Court in Alaska has ruled, and they've determined for purposes of Alaska law, registration on a sex offender registry is considered not regulatory but a punishment. So under that ruling, even though somebody is registered in another state by coming here and being put onto the Alaska registry, that quote-unquote regulatory or administrative action of placing them on the registry is in fact under Alaska law a punishment. On those grounds, we believe that the court would again rule that it is ex post facto. Understand that the Department of Law takes a different position and is asked to litigate this, but we are trying to be as clear as possible in what the state of the law is and why this is problematic.
Thank you, Mr. Mittman. So like they say on TV, I guess we'll see you in court.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We do appreciate your input. So with that, the objection is maintained. Susan, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Herron?
No.
Representative Gatto?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Grunberg?
Yes.
Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Representative Rammers?
No.
2 yes, 5 no.
Thank you. So the amendment to the amendment fails. So we now have amendment number 8 before us. Representative Dahlstrom has objected. Mr. Shabatny, can you, just to refresh all of us because it's been a week, can you take us back to the embedded problem with number 8? And so I'm a layperson. Tell me if I understand this correctly. We have two standards of people that are put on our sexual offender registry, 15 years and for life. And so if you come from another state and you're only required to be on a sex offender registry for 5 years and 10 months, we don't have an egg timer that is customizable presently to the other 49 states. And so the concern is that if we put you back on a 15-year, on the registry for 15 years to mere Alaska's law, then, in fact, we have added an additional length and increment of a penalty to the sentence that you have come to our state with from a previous state. And that's the rub of what we're up against. Is that correct?
I think I don't need to say anything other than you summarized it well.
All right. And so what will be the state's posture then if we pass Amendment Number 8? Who would make a court challenge, and what would the state's posture be going forward to defend itself from a court challenge if we pass Amendment Number 8? And can you give us the downside if Amendment Number 8 doesn't pass and you come from another state? Then, as I thought I heard the Attorney General say, is that in effect we have sex offenders that can move here that then are not forced to register because there's not an alignment of that crime that happened in that state doesn't align with the crime that happened here.
That's correct. There are two types of states that have tiers like we do, 15 years in life. And there are states like Minnesota who have a risk assessment, and you register indefinitely till you're no longer a risk. In a state like Minnesota, you may be convicted of a burglary, but you still get the risk assessment and have to register as a sex offender. Under Alaska law, there's no burglary that's equivalent to a sex offense. So a person coming from Minnesota now doesn't have to register in the state. So that's what the Attorney General was saying. And I'm sorry I lost the second part of your question.
How will the Department of Law defend itself?
Oh.
If challenged.
We get back to the regulatory versus punitive part about it. We're regulating sex offenders who come to this state. We're giving public notice as to how long that the person who is living next door to you and your children are a sex offender. So it's not that we're punishing them for coming to Alaska, but we're saying because you have a sex offense in another state, you're going to have to register for 15 years or life, depending upon which tier you would fall in.
Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we talking about I believe from last week's conversation, that you said there's very few states that have this, that do not have the 15-year and higher tiers. There's very few states that have the 10-year tier, right? Is that correct, sir?
If I said that, I don't know that I spoke exactly correctly. There are more states that have tiering than have the risk assessment, basically because of the cost and the difficulty. And some people say it's real easy to give an instrument a test and figure out what the risk is. That and that the Adam Walsh Act, which many states try to come into compliance, require a three-tier system. So the majority of them is tiering like we have. I don't think I didn't mean to say that most states were 10 years or 25 years or.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, so the Department of Law supports Amendment Number 8 as it's presently written.
8. Right questions.
Actually, this is dealing with the effective the whether. Yes, we are. Sorry.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Svobodny, this is the two-page amendment number 8 we're talking about. We're not just talking about the thing we talked about on my amendment. We're talking about the whole two-page amendment number 8. Do you need a copy of that, Rick?
I thought you were talking about the amendments to...
We'll take a brief of these. We're not... We're back on the record. Mr. Svobodny. The question before us is whether the Department of Law supports Amendment Number 8 to House Bill 298, since this is a crux of our concern about attracting sex offenders to the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, I have a concern about it being by regulation of the Department of Public Safety as opposed to just being the law, which is in your first line. So to answer specifically your question, I prefer the amendment that the state proposed, but like yours better than just leaving it as is, the bill as is.
Well said. So we have before us Amendment Number 8. Representative Dahlstrom, do you maintain your objection? Representative Gatto.
Thanks.
I'm good.
The only thing we're trying to do is make sure that we don't serve as the honey for the beehive and cause somebody to call up and say, what's the laws in Alaska? I don't have to register? Where's my ticket agent? and come up here and escape the registration. That's, I believe, that's what we're trying to do, is to prevent carpetbaggers coming up here and being sex offenders and having us unable to know, or have the public unable to know. So how do we fix that?
Through the chair, the bill fixes that. I mean, if the bill itself, if it passes, says that people who are required to register in another state need to register here. And Ms. Manfreda can tell you how many of those phone calls that you just described she gets. She gets a lot of them. The issue here is, when you come, are you in the 15-year tier or in the life tier? That's what the amendment does.
And I heard from Representative Gatto. Kathy Manfreda, are you still with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Kathy, can you tell us how many of those phone calls you do get?
We can tell you that we haven't specifically tracked how many calls are for that specific purpose, but since the decision was made by the Alaska Supreme Court, our number of phone calls from offenders has tripled.
Up to what? 3 a day?
So is it 2 a month? Is it 10 a month?
700 a month. 5 to 700 a month.
How many?
Cow.
All right, thank you very much.
Yearly total.
Sure. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Svobodny, I think we are confused by your testimony a minute ago. It sounds like what you really would prefer, rather than this amendment, which was up at the top, A6, the amendment you would prefer is another amendment that was proposed by the Department of Law. And that has no amendment number. It wasn't a lockup amendment. It says Department of Law 15, and it talks about 15 years if the person's been convicted of only one offense, and for life if they've been convicted of two or more offenses. Am I correct? Was that what you were referring to?
Through the chair, yes. It also doesn't, you might notice that it doesn't include child kidnapping. That one we know from the other states, and it actually makes it part of the law as opposed to regulation by the public safety.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to be sure that people understood what Mr. Savadi's testimony was. He prefers this one that they originally prepared rather than... What, say again? Oh, there's an A20, I'm told.
So we have amendment number 8 that's before us is A.6. The amendment that was not offered, but is available, is A.20.
I don't know. Yeah. I have to look.
We're going to take a brief at ease, or we will make copies of A.20. We're back on the record. As the offer of amendment number 8, I withdraw it. Amendment number 8 has been withdrawn. I am now going to offer amendment number 19. Amendment number 19 is Luckup A.20. Members should have that before them. Kathy Manfreda, can you speak to amendment number 19?
Mr. Chairman, I'll object.
Representative Holmes objects for the purpose of discussion.
This is Kathy Bonfreda for the record.
I want to say you alarmed all of us, I think, with this by citing the statistic that 500 to 700 people a month are inquiring about coming to Alaska.
Could I make an amendment for the record? I slightly misspoke. The record number of phone calls we get per month from all contacts is around a little over 500 a month, about 135 per month from offenders.
I don't think that made any of us in this room feel the least bit safer.
Which I do to our tourism industry.
It's astonishing.
It is astonishing. So, Kathy, can you just very briefly give us a sense of this, and then we'll ask Mr. Svobodny, and then we'll see if there's any comments around the table.
For the record, this is Kathy Manfreda again. Mr. Chairman, Department of Public Safety supports this amendment. It would make managing of the offenders that fall into this category the same as it would for the current offenders, and as opposed to having to determine the duration requirements in other states.
Very good. Mr. Svobodny, your thoughts on amendment number 19, A.20?
So we support it here, Mr. Chairman.
Very good.
Although I'll just leave it there.
Well said. Comments around the table, Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, my concern about the amendment as written is that we might still end up in the position where we have people who can get out from under this through a constitutional challenge because you might have people who in their home state are only required to register for another year. They come up here and they're required to register for 15 years or life, and I'm afraid that we could end up with a constitutional challenge, and that's not, I want these people registering, and I don't want to set up a system under which we end up in court and all these people end up not having to register after all.
Well, it keeps them out.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's if it serves the purpose of them deciding not to come up here, I think then it will have accomplished its purpose.
Indeed, at lunch today, Ralph Samuels was speaking in another part of Juneau, and he used to sit in your seat, Representative Holmes, and sometimes I marveled at the way he enjoyed wielding justice from his seat on the House Judiciary Chair, which was let him sue, let him challenge. Let's build the fence first, and let somebody try and hurdle their way over it. So your point is duly noted. Are there other comments, Representative Herring?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question you've the chair has withdrawn Amendment Number 8. So I guess my question related to 19 is, what about the amendment to Number 8 that we passed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunberg.
I don't think that amendment
failed. Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Okay. That amendment, which dealt with part of the ex post facto problem.
This is the amendment that failed to the amendment that was withdrawn. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I just want to make sure I have the right context.
Yes. All right. That's your question, yes.
And it's 3 o'clock.
Okay. Boy, you threw me off. Okay. I don't think that amendment is necessary. On further reflection, it really wasn't necessary before because we have a general applicability section that cures the constitutional problem by stating it only applies to crimes that were committed after the effective date. So I'm not going to offer it. But there is a problem, and the problem is Representative Holmes put her finger on it. I'd like the members to look at Amendment Number 8. It's really a two-part amendment.
Representative Grunberg, Amendment Number 8 has been withdrawn.
I know, but I'm looking at the language because it's very important. The language starting at line 16, which states that it only applies to persons who were required to register for a crime that's not a sex offense or child kidnapping, but for which the person is required to register as a sex offender in the other state. My question through the chair is to Representative Holmes. To cure the constitutional problem, should we not put that language into this amendment? That, I think, would cure part of the problem you're talking about.
That's the language she was pointing to.
It is on, so just to help the members here, we have before us Amendment Number 19. Representative Gruenberg is suggesting that in Amendment Number 8, the language that was, the amendment that was withdrawn, that the language beginning on line 21 and going through line 2 on page 2 be offered as an amendment to the amendment of Amendment Number 19. Is that correct, Representative?
That's right, and I think, if I may to Representative Holmes, I think that might cure the constitutional problem. Maybe I'm backwards on this, something.
My brain is not working.
Okay, I'll withdraw my comment. That's just confusing.
Sorry.
Okay.
And Representative Grunberg, AS12.63.020 is 10, is that right, Jane? 010 is precisely that in the statute book, relates to that. All right, so we have before us Amendment Number 19. Representative Holmes, you objected for the purposes of discussion. Do you maintain the objection?
If you give me just a one second, Mr.
Can we go off the record for a minute? May I talk to Representative Holmes for a minute, please?
Yes, we're taking it.
Come on, let's talk. To
Representative Grunberg, how did your conference go?
Representative Holmes.
Representative Holmes.
Fabulous, Mr. Chairman. I still think the I still have constitutional problems with Amendment 19, but I don't have other than going back to Amendment Number 8 instead, I don't have easy fix.
So is the objection maintained?
Yes, please.
Susan, will you take the roll, please?
We're voting on 19, correct?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
Pass.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg?
No.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Representative Herron?
Yes.
Representative Rammers?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
5 yes, 2 no.
All right, so with a vote of 5-2, Amendment Number 19 passes, and I will remind members that this bill goes into effect after the effective date, so it only applies to people that move to Alaska tomorrow. It doesn't apply to people that moved to Alaska as of yesterday. With that, are there any other amendments to be offered? Seeing none, is there any, Mr. Spodney, we thank you. Sergeant, we thank you very much for coming before the committee. And for the work that you do, and as cumbersome as the process is, I hope that you'll take back to the folks that you work with that we do take the matter seriously, and we hope that we have been an aid and not a hindrance, and that your experience before this committee has been a positive one generally. Is there any committee discussion? Representative Grunberg.
Just a technical matter. I would hope, and I know Jane's really good about this, that before it's given to the clerk, we can have a few minutes to look to make sure that all these voluminous amendments are put in properly. And I know she'll do that.
Representative Grunberg, that's always a courtesy that we extend to you. Is there any other committee discussion? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill number 298-26-GH2859-H with, or excuse me, /A as in apple, with as amended both conceptually and in writing, and attach physical notes with individual recommendations.
Without objection, House Bill 298 passes from committee, we will adjourn for the day at 10 minutes past 3.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative
go ahead and adjourn first.
Okay.
What I was...